Welcome to another episode of Exploring the Arts. My name is Ian McMillan, and I'm here with...
My name is Joel Thiel.
Joel Thiel, and you know, today we are interviewing another very special guest, Mr. Tyler Foster. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. So, do you just want to kick it off, Joel? Go ahead.
Let's get started. Who are you at NSA, and what do you do?
Okay, so I'm Tyler Foster. I'm the lecturer in biblical languages here. So my main thing is Hebrew. So that's kind of what I do here.
And how long have you been here?
I've been here 1 year. This is going into my second year. So
awesome.
So at the time of recording this, you're fairly new.
I am very new, yes.
So, I mean, I guess that's a springboard for just jumping into... your previous experiences before coming here. Is this your first time teaching Hebrew at a university kind of thing, or is it just a, have you taught Hebrew before?
Yeah, so as far as where have I taught Hebrew, I've taught online for a year before coming to New St. Andrews. Very different experience. So I taught and still teach with Ancient Language Institute, led by Jonathan Roberts and Ryan Hamill. Jonathan Roberts lives here actually in Moscow area as well, and then after a year I came here to New St. Andrews. Really wanted to get in the classroom face to face with my students. So
awesome. What's the difference between NSA and Ancient Language Institute? Are those like, what's the student look like at the
So Ancient Language Institute is able to offer multiple languages. They do Hebrew, they do Greek, Latin, to a wide variety of people because it's online, and so they can reach people in other countries as well as here in America. They reach a different demographic, so usually people who don't have the ability to come back to school, or don't have the time, or the desire to sit in a classroom full of college students, and so it it kind of brings it to the their living room via Zoom. Versus something like this, where it's set in the classroom, it's mostly college students, et cetera.
Awesome. What have you learned teaching at NSA this past year? What's the biggest thing?
As we're doing this interview, we just got out of the first day of Hebrew Conventiculum, and could you talk about that a little bit? What's that all about?
Okay. So we'll start with the Conventiculum.
Yeah.
So this is something that I've wanted to do for a while. Is it's an intensive course. So for us here at NSA, it's a 4-day course. So these guys were in my class, and we just hit Hebrew really, really hard for 4 days before the semester or the term starts. And we just learn a lot of vocabulary. We use it in a lot of fun ways. And the goal is to get students into the language, into realizing that it is a language, that it's something that is meant to communicate. It's a tool, not just a code to be deciphered. And so the Conventiculum sort of just is a way to get into the language really, really well at the start. What have I learned in my years here at NSA? It's a lot of work teaching. It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of work. Dealing with students face-to-face, both in the classroom. It's also fun to get to know them outside the classroom. Don't know what else to say necessarily at the moment, other than it's a lot of work.
Awesome. So I mean, let's just jump into kind of your just history with Hebrew, and then we'll move on from there. I have some other questions about like how that relates to kind of Christianity as a whole and all these things.
Okay.
But like, so just to start off, how'd you get into?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, maybe this would be a good time to start with my testimony.
Let's do it.
Because that's sort of the springboard into where I'm at now.
Totally.
So I grew up in a Christian home. My parents had both come to the doctrines of grace from an Arminian background. And so I grew up in that, would have called myself a Calvinist, Reformed, and yet I was an Arminian at heart. Okay. I thought that I had to do something to earn my way to heaven. Yeah. And I would never have even thought of it in those ways. But that is sort of the story of many years of my life, struggling with doubts of my salvation. Did I say the right prayer? Did I, the right words? Did I feel repentant enough, et cetera? And it was always with my eyes focused on myself. Did I do it well enough? It was not about what Christ had done. And so this went on for many years, and it wasn't till later teens, maybe even early 20, that God had to get a hold of me, show me that I was a hypocrite, that I was a sinner, and ultimately that I was dead. I couldn't do anything to earn salvation.
No.
And that the only thing that would do it was Christ, his blood shed for me on the cross, giving me new life, giving me the Spirit, giving me the faith to believe.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that I came to know the Lord. Now I can say, yes, I was, I'm Reformed, and I was elected all that time back, before creation, before, everything. Mm-hmm. And yet it had to work out in time, to show me, what that was like. And, with that, and after that, it was still a growing experience afterwards, but I decided that the most noble thing I could put my mind and my life towards was studying the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do when you study the Bible? Well, one of the things you do is you study the languages of the Bible. Mm-hmm. Now, before this, I'd already been interested as a kid in languages. I'd thought about Chinese, which, by the way, I still hope to take someday, Brent Pinkall. So I hope to do that, but take a little French. But this all of a sudden gave me sort of a direction with my language studies. And it was, wow, I can go to school and I can take Hebrew. So the one of the places that I was aware of that taught Hebrew was Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minnesota. So John Piper's school there in Minneapolis. And there was a Hebrew professor there, John Beckman. And I was just really, really wanted to take Hebrew with him. I was very excited. So we kind of went through the first 2 years before you could get into Hebrew. And then I found out that we were not going to get John Beckman for that year. We were going to get another guy who he only taught 1 year at Bethlehem. And we were so disappointed as students.
Those first year teachers are
really
disappointing.
I was given grace this last year, but I now I understand. So his name is Jesse Schumann. And it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me and set the trajectory for where I'm at now. Mm. So he taught a semi-spoken method of Hebrew. So it was kind of, he had to do part of the old curriculum that was taught there, which was more the grammar translation method. Yeah. And then he was able to do a little bit of his own. And so over the course of the year, we started telling stories in Hebrew, and some of us students decided we want to get together outside of class and talk to each other in Hebrew, and it sort of created this environment of using the language as a language. The goal is to read Hebrew, but you can have a lot of fun along the way, and it really cements that. I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, that's something you'll encounter a lot at NSA with Latin, especially. Is like a lot of people love talking to each other outside of class.
Right. Yeah. I'm excited to be a part of that, hopefully this year. So
it always cracks me up when people try to like speak code in Latin to like as if nobody else understands.
Right.
The one language we all speak.
And in like today in the Hebrew conventiculum, some people didn't know some certain words in Hebrew, so they would say Hebrew words interspersed with Latin words.
I heard.
Nothing but, anything but English.
Yes. Yeah. So, So anyway, the first year of Hebrew at the school, I got this sort of mixed methodology, both spoken and grammar translation, but it was a really good experience. As opposed to, hate to say it, but my Greek experience was actually quite bad. Most of us in the college lost it after the third semester or during the third semester. We just were there to get the credits, basically, to finish. So I got to see the contrast between a great Hebrew curriculum and a great great but actually not great Greek curriculum, and it affected me quite deeply. And then I'll wait to go on to the next step if you have any questions on that. So,
Well, how much of that methodology have you then carried on into your teaching?
A bit, more will come as we talk about the next step of education, which is when I went to Israel. Yeah. That's where a lot more of it was cemented. So
let's just jump right in.
You just want to jump into that? Let's do it. Sure. Okay. So I was finishing up my 4 years at Bethlehem. My last year, by the way, I did get to study with John Beckman. Okay. And one of the humblest professors I know, he was amazing. We did a lot of text based with him. But in that last year, it was on Christmas break, and I was in the student commons with a friend who became my brother-in-law. Actually, I think he was at that point too. We were going to go play ping pong, by the way. Surprise.
Hey, Dr.
I love ping pong.
We have to talk about that too.
Definitely. We went to play ping pong, and someone else was in the commons as well and started talking to my brother-in-law about this school, small school in Israel that teaches spoken languages, ancient languages as spoken. Specifically, they were talking about Greek. And my, you know, bells went off in my head, you know, is there a possibility to get my Greek to where my Hebrew is? Is it possible to salvage this? And so I started thinking about it, and moving across seas just isn't something my family's done. We're based here, where we're comfortable, in the States, and then it's expensive. I had been married for about 6 months, and so that was another thing. So I just thought, it's a cool idea. Nothing will ever happen.
Yeah.
But it kept coming back into my mind as I was going through the next month or so. And I think either my wife got annoyed at me, or she actually was getting interested herself. And she said, well, if this will turn into something, if this will turn into a job in the future, I'm willing to go. I'm willing for you to apply to this school and go to Israel. If it's just a hobby that you'll get tired of, you know, in 6 months, that's not going to be a good thing. But if it's actually going to turn into your life's work, if you're passionate about it, I'm willing to go. And so the green light came on. And so I applied with a lot of prayer. Because we weren't rich. We were college students, didn't have a lot of money, and had never done this before. And so every step of the way was bathed in lots of prayer, and God just kept opening every door. We got accepted. We got a scholarship. The visas came through, and just everything opened up, and we were able to move over to Israel for the next almost 2 years for me to study at Polis. That's the name. Polis, the Jerusalem Institute of Languages and Humanities, based in Jerusalem. And maybe some people who are watching this will have heard of it. It's right outside Damascus Gate. Basically, it's a really cool location, kind of at a crossroads of a lot of different things going on.
You said it was small, but how big was it?
So in my incoming class, probably the incoming master's class, I'm guessing there was about 15. Now, it's hard to know how big it is because there's so many different languages that are taught there, and I'm only in a few of them. So they teach Arabic. They teach biblical and modern Hebrew. They teach Greek. They do Coptic sometimes. Okay. They do a couple others. I think they finally got into Latin while I was there. So there's lots of different directions. So you might not see people all the time and know how big it is. Yeah. And then COVID happened. And so then you're just on a computer screen. Sure. So you really don't see people other than in your little camera window.
So you were in Israel on Zoom calls?
Yes. Yes. It was awful. We were quarantined in our homes. You couldn't go, you know, very far. Quarantined on Zoom for church, for classes. A good friend of mine finally he left partway through the last semester because there was no point. There was no point in saying he had a family, some kids, and so he was smart.
Okay, awesome. And what was that? You talking about some of your teaching style has come from your studies at Polis. How did that affect you?
Yeah, so Polis has what they call the Polis method. Now, all of these, there's a lot of methods out there, direct method, TPR. They're all kind of doing the same thing, similar to what you guys experienced in class, where we want to use the language as much as possible in class. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, Polis takes it to a very high bar of instruction in the language, and so they really don't want any English at all. Now, in my class today, there was once in a while I'd throw in something. It can help. Polis was very strict on that, and it's a good thing. It's helpful. It's difficult to do that, especially for a lot of people who have not been trained that way. So a lot of people have been trained in a grammar translation method, for instance. To move into a Polis method, you almost have to go somewhere and learn that way. Go for a year or two and actually study under someone who's constantly speaking the language. But I took away a lot from Polis for my own methodology of staying mostly in the language, doing a lot of physical activities with the language. So you guys were the guinea pigs of that, you know, get up, sit down, grab the cow, you know, put the cow on the house. Like, it's very simple and silly stuff, but it's very useful. And so that when you go to read a text and you see a Hebrew phrase, like, for instance, most people won't understand this, but sim et ha par alabait, okay? That means place the cow on the house. If you were to see that in text now, you've been doing it and doing it and doing it, it would sort of come alive to you. You would now see it in your mind. You would understand what that's doing because you've done it yourselves. So yeah, I've taken a lot of the active methodology into the classroom, and I love it.
That kind of method is, I love that because that's how the Latin is set up here as well, especially in the second year. Like I was taking Virgil last year, and Tim Griffith, the Latin professor, he comes in, just starts going. We're talking in Latin the whole class time, and it's really fast. It's really difficult, but it's really, really fun.
That's fantastic. One of the things I wanted to double click on here was, so you kind of touched on it a little bit, but in kind of relation to, you know, the Christian generally, what, I guess first question is just like, what value is there in studying the original languages for like personal devotion or just knowledge of the scriptures and these sorts of things? So I'll ask that, then we can kind of go about that.
This is a question that I've actually been seeking to understand better myself, because I've been in languages for a number of years now, and everyone has an answer. You type this into a, you know, a chat on Facebook, and you'll get, you know, 50 different answers. So I don't think there's any one answer, but I'll give a couple reasons that I think is beneficial. First of all, let me be very clear that not every Christian has to study Greek and Hebrew. In fact, you can have a much more humble person who doesn't take the languages because the languages have that the ability to puff one up if they're not careful and also lead to a lot of heresy.
Okay.
And for those who know the languages, it's actually very dangerous. So you need to maybe start off with that. Not everyone needs to, and in fact, it's dangerous. Where is it beneficial? Mm-hmm. Well, we need people in every age that can read the languages. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, so that things can't happen without our knowledge. Things can't disappear out of our texts without our knowledge. There's a lot of people who know Hebrew that are not Christians. They can argue that the Bible's not real. They can argue that Jonah was not a real person or it's just a fable. They can argue all of this stuff. And a lot of times they'll bring in the Hebrew to make their point. Yeah. And they sound really good. Mm-hmm. We need people, Christians, who use the languages to be able to argue from a Christian perspective and be able to go into history of the language, into uses of the language. So that's one aspect. Hebrew is a tool. Mm-hmm. Hebrew is a way for you to see things in a different way, with more clarity. Hebrew, if you are reading a story, okay, one Hebrew word could show up in Genesis 1, 2, or 3. It could also show up the same Hebrew word maybe in Genesis 8, mm-hmm. okay? In fact, there's a lot of similarities between the creation and the flood.
Yeah.
Now, in English, because translation is the way it is, and it's a little bit more fluid, you might miss connections. Why? Because the English word might be different. They might have said, well, in this context, I'm going to use a different word here.
You miss the like literary devices.
You miss the literary devices. Yeah. Whereas in Hebrew, you see the word, the same word, and you make the connection a lot quicker. Mm. Hebrew is a great language for doing that. It's a root-based language. I mean, so is Latin, so is Greek, but it's very root-based. So the same consonants you'll see in lots of different variations and forms, and it can help you to make those connections a lot easier. Hebrew is a tool. It's a useful tool. It's not a necessary tool per se to every Christian, but it can help you to in your preparation for sermons, in your personal devotional life. But you have to be careful. It's like a saw. You can cut off your finger if you're not careful. Yeah. But it can also build a beautiful bookshelf or something else.
And I've heard people say that Hebrew is a language designed to be ambiguous. That context is really important.
Yeah.
So like compared to maybe Latin or Greek with your studies, how much more important is context in Hebrew?
Yeah, extremely.
Okay.
Extremely. Yes. So one Hebrew word can mean many, 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 many English words. And some of times they don't seem to cross. They don't seem to make sense. Like, why would this mean this?
Sure.
This is silly. One of my favorite things reading through Genesis is there's a Hebrew word, kaved. Kavod, kaved, it means heavy. And so we think of it as glory. Kavod, God is glorious, etc. But it means heavy, okay? Mm-hmm. And so there's a phrase that Avraham kaved me'od. So if I said just that, Avraham kaved me'od, Abraham was extremely heavy. that's not what it means. It goes on to clarify with context, with what? With animals, with gold, with silver. So then him being heavy with gold and silver and all of this kind of thing, it's not like they're weighted in his clothes. He's just a very wealthy man. Mm-hmm. That's just one of my favorite examples. It's very context-driven. It's a much smaller vocabulary, much smaller than Greek and Latin. Yeah. And so once you learn, which is good for the student, once you learn a set amount of vocabulary, you can read a lot in that genre. So for instance, the genre that beginning students will be learning is a lot of history, a lot of narrative. So you'll be reading lots of narrative texts. Mm-hmm. Once you learn a base vocabulary for that, you can read a lot of the Old Testament with a little bit of help for new vocab, but a lot of the basics are the same. So it actually makes it easier eventually to learn than something like Greek or Latin.
There's also Hebrew poetry as well.
There is.
What does that look like?
Hard, to be honest. Hebrew poetry, the rules go out the window. I can't say a lot about Hebrew poetry. I'm not an expert. You should talk to Dr. Edwards at some point in your Hebrew career. Mm-hmm. I was privileged to sit in with him doing some Hebrew poetry. It's really hard. Can be very ambiguous, but it's different. It's different than Greek, Latin, English. It's not about, well, I don't think there's debate out there on what makes Hebrew poetry. It doesn't seem to be anything with rhyme. It doesn't seem to be anything with meter, although some would disagree with me. Jerome, I think, being one of them, but we'll set that aside. But it seems to be more about the ideas.
And like you were talking about with Abraham, was heavy with gold and silver. I'm sure there are so many different little insights or something that you gain into the Old Testament with your studies of Hebrew. And I know in my own studies with languages, little like nuggets like that you discover, oh, that's connected to that. That's the English derivative from that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. What are some of your favorite insights that you gained into the Old Testament?
As far as like derivatives, there's not as much. There's not like, whereas in Latin, you'll have a lot of words that even sound like the English. There's not a lot of that in Hebrew. It's much more foreign. But what you do get in Hebrew is idioms that cross over, actually. And I think, I haven't studied this, and I'd be fascinated to know, but it seems that from maybe the King James, maybe the Latin, whatever, some of those might have been brought into English. Some of those would be his nose burned. I know that's not exactly the English idiom, but it's similar to a short fuse or a burning fuse would mean an angry person. Mm-hmm. Or a long nose doesn't mean Pinocchio. Okay, that's a little dangerous. But it means one that's not burning. It's patient. It's long-suffering. It's one that's not burning. So you have these sort of, they're using things like anthropomorphic, like on the nose, like the nose or different things to give across. What does that look like? A red nose probably means he's angry. So things like that. I think idioms sometimes sort of come across, and it's always fun. There's a better one out there, and I always forget it. So I wish I'd remember.
You'll remember it right after we finish this.
By tomorrow, okay.
Awesome. How has Hebrew changed since ancient Hebrew, from Hebrew to modern Hebrew? What are differences?
A bit. There's been a bit of change. I'm not an expert on all the changes. So you have biblical Hebrew, and then it moves into more of the rabbis. Obviously, it was still used in the synagogue throughout time, but not as a modern language. You get Yiddish, which is sort of a mix between German and Hebrew, but again, that's not pure Hebrew. And then you get into eventually modern Hebrew. Eliezer ben Yehuda, he was sort of the first one to bring Hebrew into the modern world, in a sense, as a spoken language. And from what I understand, it was controversial even in his day. You don't take a sacred language, the language of the Bible, and put it into common parlance and common speech. But he did it. It was amazing. Yeah. He did it through, you know, speaking, through the newspaper, media, and eventually it became a modern language. As far as the similarities and differences, you can use Biblical Hebrew in Israel today, okay, to an extent. A lot of the basic vocab is the same. So if you were to take, after this year, you could take a modern Hebrew class, and you would probably know 50% of the vocabulary. Why? Because get up, sit down, place the cup on the table. All of these things would be the same in modern Hebrew. What you don't get is store and radiator and television and pizza and whatnot. Yeah. And so what modern Hebrew really had to do was bring those in. So you get radiator, televisia, pizza. Okay. It's not all like that. There's a lot more than that. But so they had to add a lot and take it from different languages, not just English, but they would sort of borrow from other languages, and then also take old Hebrew words and sort of give them new life. My favorite example here is there's this verb, nahag, and it means to drive or to drive out. Mm. And so this is used, I think, of God in the Old Testament. He drives out like the people of Israel or drives them out of Egypt. I forget where it is exactly. But in modern Israel, the guy who drives your bus is a nahag. and so they're going to recycle words. They have sort of a history, but they'll make new meaning with that. And so it's actually quite fascinating. You'll sound, if you use Biblical Hebrew, you'll sound like Shakespeare. People will look at you funny and not respond exactly how you speak. They'll respond with modern Hebrew or English. They'll say, dumb Americans.
Awesome. Well, going back to your time in Israel, especially before COVID shut everything down, besides school, like what were you doing? What was your experience like?
Yeah. It was great. So the school didn't just teach Hebrew and Greek, but they also did like a geography class where we would spend, instead of 10 days on a tour, which is what most people get, I got it like over the course of 2 years. So we would go to different sites, not just biblical sites. We would get Roman history as well as biblical, maybe Greek, different time periods, maybe even some Arabic locations. So just different things like that. So geography was so much fun. Go for a day at an ancient ruins and have your professor walk around and talk about the architecture, when it was. Maybe you'll find some Latin or Greek writing embedded in the stones, and you know the nerds will be there trying to figure out what it says, and you know, maybe seeing a gate that Abraham could have walked through, or going to Galilee up at the north. Tell Dan. So basically you get to go all over Israel for 2 years on these trips. So that was a lot of fun. Just living. Had to open a bank account, rent an apartment, sign a contract, which was rough at the end when we had to close out. We got caught. We got stung. Didn't know enough Hebrew at that point. Going to the grocery store and trying to figure out what food is and how much it costs because we use a different currency. Mm-hmm. It really makes you feel for people in the stores here that maybe don't speak English. You start to realize, it's not as easy as I've always thought to figure things out. It's foreign. It actually looks weird. Figuring out a bus system in a different language and how to get to church if you don't want to walk an hour. A Shabbat, the buses aren't running for the Jewish buses. So you either take an Arab bus or you take a taxi or you walk, or you get your pastor to pick you up, which also was helpful.
What are the churches like in Israel? Yeah.
So we were at a fairly international church. Menno Kalischer is a well-known pastor in Israel. He was our pastor. So this one was always Hebrew and English at the front, so from the pulpit, with a translator, and then in the congregation, lots of languages were happening with little microphones and translators throughout the congregation, just helping people who didn't understand Hebrew or English. Most of them are not as international as that, but still, at least generally, you'll have a Hebrew and English because those two languages are very, very major in Israel, along with Arabic and different things. But Hebrew and English are pretty common. You'll have some American churches, or at least what feel like American churches, with music and whatnot. It's a pretty small community. Most of the churches know of each other, and maybe even have, things that they do in common. Generally, at least the Christians there, the Jewish Christians don't actually call themselves Christians, because there's actually a sort of a stigma, along with it. It means Catholic, really, okay, in Israel. Everything's Catholic. So if you're a Christian, you're most likely Catholic. Or else you may not get in good with the normal Jews, if you're so-called Christian. There's also a lot of history there. So
interesting.
But a good experience on the whole. Loved the country. Couldn't see myself living there for the rest of my life, definitely a beautiful place to visit and a lot of history.
Well, that's wonderful. Before we close, I wanted to talk about ping pong.
Yes. So do I.
Yeah. So you play ping pong with Dr. Herb.
I do.
Yeah. So tell us about that.
You started a club.
Yeah. You started a club here. Yeah. What's that all about?
Well, going back to Bethlehem is where my ping pong days started.
Yeah.
I was terrible. And there was a ping pong table in the commons. What do? You play ping pong as a student. So it was our sport. You guys get rugby and stuff. We get ping pong. I don't know if it was freshman or sophomore year, but it started to get pretty serious among the students. You'd be playing. So I started with a friend of mine. We were both terrible, just awful ping pong players. And just over the course of the next, 3-4 years, playing with each other and then playing people better than us, we just really got into it and got a lot better. And they did tournaments, a couple tournaments while I was there. Never won, of course. I wasn't that good. So I've always enjoyed it since then. I did a little bit in Israel just for fun. And then I came here, and I didn't even know for the first 6 months that anybody played ping pong until the Christmas party, which happened in January, and I'd started hearing rumors about Dr. Herb. Caleb Salmon wanted to play with him, and someone plays ping pong. So I dusted off the old bat and came prepared, and didn't win. He smoked me that night, but I must have given him enough run for his money that we started playing. thank you, Dr. Herb. It's been so much fun if you hear this. So we started playing at his garage off and on, and then we got a nicer table for the North Campus. And then we decided, ping pong club. That would be fun. Get the students into it. Be able to maybe eventually get nicer equipment. Yeah. And it's a sport that anyone can do. It's not, the stronger versus the weaker as far as like physical strength is not a thing.
Yeah.
So it's great for really anyone. And so we thought, and it's like winter about 9 months of the year here. So, yeah. You know, it's nice. You can do something inside. It doesn't take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
It can get expensive if you want it to, but it doesn't have to be that expensive.
Yeah.
And so, we're starting the ping pong club, this term, if we can. So yeah.
Hear that, NSA students. Talk to Mr. Foster or Dr. Herb for a ping pong club.
Here. Yes, please come. Join us.
And aside from ping pong, what are some of your other hobbies outside of work?
I love woodworking. So I grew up the son of a floor installer. My dad had his own business and taught us to work with our hands, putting in hard surface flooring, tile, laminate, hardwood, working around saws, equipment. And so as a teenager, I got into a little bit of furniture building. And then when I was in Israel, I actually got to do some projects for the school as part of my help to pay tuition a little bit.
Yeah.
And then whenever I can on the side here. So actually the aron in class, the chest that we use in class, I built a couple weeks ago.
That's awesome.
And so I enjoy woodworking. So
awesome.
Awesome.
Great. Well, yeah. Sweet.
Okay,
well,
this has been fantastic.
That brings us to the end here. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So it was a pleasure.
Yeah.